Standing at the bar in the Three Bladders, Floyd ordered a pint of peculiar and a neat vodka. Frankel, until then invisible beneath the counter, climbed up onto a stool.
Pint of God's finest, and yours will be the short, sir,
inquired the barman jovially. Frankel, more than a little self-conscious of his diminished stature, made up for his lack of height with a larger-than-life chip on the shoulder. Grabbing the pint, he treated the barman to a baleful stare.
Sorry, sonny, natural mistake,
confessed the barman. Frankel reddened perceptibly as the second unwise observation struck a nerve.
One more stupid remark, and you're a dead man,
greeted Frankel through clenched teeth.
No, sir. Let's not get upset over so small a matter,
consoled the barman, realizing just too late his mistake. Frankel, now insulted beyond tolerance, grabbed the barman's tie and hauled himself upwards in a single move. Floyd saved the barman's life by tapping Frankel sharply on the temple with a rock-hard sausage from the display of bar food. Chubby Roland was fortifying himself with extremely large brandies when Frankel and Floyd arrived. Seeing the two strangers in the bar, he felt duty-bound to engage them in pleasant conversation. He'd just about gotten over his earlier shock, and comfortable numbness replaced the violent knee trembles. In the manner of all inebriates, Roland felt that his stimulating company was just what the newcomers needed to cheer them up. Lurching towards them, he fumbled for a suitable topic of conversation.
Hi,
he began, spilling half a pint of special over Frankel's shoulder. Floyd whispered to Roland,
not to mention height.
Oh, sorry, perhaps I should have said no.
Frankel gritted his teeth as Roland sat down, resting his elbow on the dwarf's head. Though he was not to know it, the rambling conversation that he was about to embark on would save his life. For even as he began to make himself comfortable by squashing the dwarf against the wall, Frankel was reaching for the stiletto in his left sock. Hubert, now shorter by 2 feet, dragged himself painfully forward. The crocodile, now grinning contentedly and lacking its human adversary's sheer cunning, was totally unaware of the fiendishly clever plot being devised to kill it. Gold-spangled crash helmet firmly wedged in place, our hero prepared for battle. His new strategy was the result of his observations of the reptile in previous encounters. Crocodiles, he reasoned, could not chew their prey. They could only tear and swallow. Armed with this single fact, Hubert had, in a flash of inspiration, worked out a foolproof, if risky, ploy. As the crocodile opened its mouth in anticipation of yet another free meal, Hubert braced himself. His plan, deceptively simple, was to launch himself head first straight into the crocodile's mouth, and then, by forcing it to swallow him whole, choke it to death. With a loud battle cry, Hubert sprang forward. At that moment, old Faircloth burst into the reptile house, just in time to see a truncated figure in a red PVC jumpsuit vanish from sight. The crocodile licked its lips and wagged its tail happily as the retired zookeeper stared in horror and disbelief. In the snug at the Three Bladders, Roland snored drunkenly as his two companions, Frankel and Floyd, exchanged knowing glances. The inebriate gardener had bored them to the very point of pain, but something in his dull monologue had stopped Frankel at the very moment of murder. Just as the point of his knife was about to slip between Roland's ribs, the old chap had mentioned a flying boy, a considerable sum of money, and the big house. It occurred to the villainous pair that they now had all the ingredients for a rapid wealth creation scheme. Roland could hardly believe his luck. Here were two men buying him drinks and listening attentively to his strange tale. Before he knew it, the whole story was out. Alfred's disappearance, his uncle's desperate search for him, the house with its bizarre contents, the Jehovah hat stand, and the hint of a large sum of money. This, of course, was exactly the direction that Floyd had hoped this conversation might go. And as Roland lapsed into a drunken coma, Frankel and Floyd slunk silently from the pub to examine their hostage in the back of the hearse. Back at the abandoned zoo, old Fairclough wrung his hands in despair. He had arrived just too late to save Hubert from the crocodile's gaping maw. Pounding it on the back, Fairclough did his best to make it cough. But to no avail. The creature was in no mood to lose its lunch. Expert animal handler as he was, the keeper could not quite bring himself to put his fingers down its throat. Hubert's shape inside the crocodile could clearly be seen, wriggling, struggling, and punching, equally reluctant to give up the fight as the creature continued to gulp and swallow. Struck suddenly with what seemed like a pretty good idea, Fairclough ran from the reptile house and, bounding over the fence, made his way to the chemist's. Boris Puck called Roland into the study.
Come here, you vile jelly.
In his hand was a piece of paper. Roughly glued onto the paper were letters and words cut out of the Daily Mirror.
We've got the boy,
it proclaimed tastelessly in lurid block capitals. Roland was not feeling at all well. The hangover he was experiencing and the uncomfortable nearness of the Jehovah hat stand had both served to unsettle him considerably.
Been out on the tiles?
Inquired Boris somewhat menacingly. Roland nodded, wincing slightly as the gentle movement of his head made the room swim.
When I employed you,
Boris began,
I distinctly remember stipulating a gardener who could keep his mouth shut.
Roland gulped as the room swam out of focus. Boris slowly explained that certain persons, in possession of certain knowledge, gained by way of a chance conversation in the Three Bladders, had seen fit to send him a ransom note. Roland went several shades whiter and shrank backwards as Boris fondled the stock of his favourite elephant gun.
It would appear,
Boris continued,
that this information came from you.
Roland, now staring in alarm down the barrel of Boris's hunting piece, began to explain himself. The well-oiled click of the safety mechanism being disengaged brought his explanation to a very untidy halt. Boris always liked to give a chap a sporting chance, and as Roland ran from the house, he lowered the gun momentarily.
I'll get the blighter on the next fence,
he muttered, pulling back the hammer. Taking care not to damage the hide where it might show, Boris took careful aim.
You're fired,
he bellowed, replacing the still-smoking weapon in its cabinet. Marmalade, Roland's cat, glared from under the chaise lounge. If it could have spoken, it would probably have said, I'll get you for that, you blighter, or some such thing. But being a cat, it of course said nothing, which was fortunate because Boris had no love of cats and plenty of space in the attic. Lying amongst the cabbages as the life ebbed from him, Roland wondered whether or not there was an afterlife, and bitterly regretted not going to confession that week. Completely unaware of all that was taking place, young Alfred sat miserably he knew not where. For some days now, he had been kept prisoner by unknown assailants. Head still wedged in the watering can, his discomfort was considerable. Frankel and Floyd had seen the wisdom of leaving the can in place, maintaining their anonymity. Unable to eat or drink in the conventional way, Alfred was nourished by the occasional insertion of a sausage down the spout of the can, or by pumping baked beans and mashed potato in under pressure. All this was very messy and could only add to his distress. Today he was to be returned, as Frankel assured him, to the bosom of his family. That was, of course, if his uncle paid up. Alfred shuddered, the joy of going home soured by an unpleasant memory of Myrtle's bosom, the only one he'd ever known. It formed an objectionable image in his mind that would just not go away. Boris counted out the last of the ransom money and stuffed it into a large briefcase. There seemed no option. In order to inherit his share of the Park Trust, and a good deal of his nephew's too, he had to produce the boy in person to Messrs. Grip, Mangle and Reticule for the reading. Only when they were satisfied as to the boy's good health and well-being would the last details of his mother's will be finally revealed. No one knew the full extent of the Park Trust. It had been set up secretly by Elsie Park 8 months before Alfred's birth and maintained by herself and old Mr. Grip in complete secrecy. Boris could only guess at the sums of money involved, but with Alfred so malleable, he knew it would only be a matter of time before it was all in his hands. That was, if he could get the boy back. There was no way he was going to let this opportunity slip through his fingers. Even so, the thought of Frankel and Floyd walking away with the entire contents of his wall safe in exchange for the boy's safe return was more than he was able to bear. Carefully decanting the nitric acid into the strange apparatus packed with ice in the Victorian hip bath, the old fellow prepared for his appointment. Back at the reptile house, Fairclough paced to and fro. He'd spent too long searching for the crocodile to see any harm come to it now. But even so, he could not stand by and let a fellow human being be so ignominiously ingested. Trapping the crocodile in a corner, the old zookeeper poured an evil mixture of cod liver oil, syrup of figs and centipods into its gaping mouth. Nothing more could be done. Fairclough sat down and waited for nature to take its course. Inside the crocodile, Hubert still struggled for survival, the huge reptile, now realizing that it had bitten off more than it could chew, gulped and swallowed uncomfortably. A fearful noise reverberated around the concrete confines as the crocodile shifted its position. Eyes glazed, tongue flickering, the creature's unhappy expression changed from deep misery to complete despair as the chemical cocktail did its worst. Fairclough waited like an expectant father as the gurgles and rumbles grew in intensity and volume. The creature was now coiled in agony in the corner of the enclosure and emitting unhappy squeals as it writhed and twitched. Suddenly, a terrible rasping noise escaped from the crocodile as its expression changed from misery to unexpected relief, and Hubert emerged cursing and befouled in an explosion of reptilian excretia.
Dr. Livingstone, I presume?
Oh, well done. Boris Park, briefcase clutched firmly in hand, strode to the center of the standing stones to meet Frankel and Floyd. He wondered briefly what manner of villain would choose such a melodramatic spot for a meeting. The old stone circle built by some prehistoric tribe incalculable ages ago stood on a high point some distance from the big house. As Boris sat on the pile-inducing center slab, once used by druids for unspeakable acts and strange rituals to appease ancient and now long-forgotten gods, the forces of evil were already gathering. Frankel and Floyd observed from a distance the lonely figure now lost in thought, waiting for a while to make sure he was quite alone. The ill-matched couple advanced under the cover of the gathering darkness. Both men jumped involuntarily as the cell phone beeped. Frankel found it hard to reconcile his partner's love of the Gothic with this singularly inappropriate device. And as he climbed out of the ditch they had both fallen into when the frightful object had sounded off, he contemplated jumping on it at the very next opportunity. Boris turned to face the dreadful commotion of noises emanating from the ditch. Two soiled figures were emerging, one short and covered in muck, the other much taller and only half covered in muck. The shorter of the two was bouncing up and down on a small rectangle of broken plastic, whilst the other was remonstrating noisily and waving long, gangling arms at him. Boris hefted the briefcase and started to walk towards them.
Messrs. Frankel and Floyd, I presume?
He interrupted. The two men jerked upright and turned to face him.
Where's the boy?
He bellowed as they abandoned their dispute and recomposed themselves.
So did you bring the money?
Hissed Frankel, reaching for the briefcase. Boris poked him in the eye and tightened his grip on the money. As Frankel clasped his injured face, Floyd motioned to Boris to open the case. Satisfied as to its contents, he pointed to the hearse at the bottom of the hill.
All neatly tucked up, Governor.
Hissed Floyd as he reached for the case. Boris poked Floyd in the eye too, and waited patiently whilst both men nursed their injured faces.
Yes, well, you made your point, Governor. I'll get him,
said Floyd testily, sending the dwarf to fetch young Alfred.
Oh, boy. Fire serum.
Boris, hand on Alfred's shoulder, watched grim-faced as the two shadowy figures strode away, one carrying the briefcase filled with money, the other a broken cell phone. Alfred maneuvered the spout of the watering can, still wedged on his head, towards his uncle, and squawked unintelligibly.
Don't worry, lad, said Boris at length. I'll be getting it all back with interest in about 2 minutes.
Frankel and Floyd could barely contain their evil glee as they ran back down the hill, lugging the bulging case. Neither man was aware of the small additional package cut into the lining. Scrambling over the hedge, Floyd called out to Frankel to pass him the bag. Frankel hurled the case over the hedge and prepared to follow it.
Nitroglycerine,
beamed Boris by way of an explanation.
No bugger gets my life savings without a fight.
Boris's satisfaction was ended abruptly by the realization that the tiny pieces of burning debris fluttering gently down from the sky comprised not only of Frankel and Floyd, but also the contents of the bag.
Damn and blast!
Amongst the mud and debris in the ditch, a concussed and blast-stained dwarf cursed and spat. Of his former companion, nothing remained but smouldering shards. Frankel picked amongst the pieces, trying to identify a familiar tattoo or a recognizable limb, but to no avail. Floyd was completely gone, as if he had never existed. Vapor and ashes. Frankel's display of grief was truly touching. Tears flowed down his blackened face as he stumbled from the ditch, a wretched and pitiful sight. PC Wormhole, pride of Brick Street Constabulary, had been raking around in a gorse patch just to the north of Dunghenge. After the bombing of the police station, all available resources had been directed at a search for anarchist saboteurs. And to this end, the constable had been looking under bushes and examining ditches for any hint of subversive activity in the field. His colleagues had expressed considerable doubt as to the likelihood of finding an anarchist bomb factory in the thickets around an ancient monument, but having exhausted all other possibilities, left him to it. He was thus alone when an explosion flung him into the hedge.
"Blimey!"
he marvelled, as he picked himself up and ran towards the sound of falling debris. In and around the crumbling offices in Gray's Inn Road, conflicting forces were about to gather. Old Mr. Grip, no longer recognizable, collapsed inwards with a dry cracking sound. A sudden change in the room temperature wreaked havoc with his rigor mortis. Mangle and Reticule coughed loudly and shuffled papers to cover the noises from the office next door. Boris and Alfred entered the room. Hubert, the human cannonball, still smelling horribly of crocodile guano and now considerably reduced in caliber, was wheeled in by Myrtle, rid of her vacuum cleaner, but now encumbered by a wicker bath chair in which the smelly Hubert painfully reclined, somewhat legless. Boris, using a pair of bolt cutters recently purchased from a local ironmonger, snipped expertly at the watering can imprisoning Alfred's head, finally revealing his ward. Mangle had been hoping up till now that Boris had been up to some sort of subterfuge, looked almost disappointed as Alfred was revealed, messy, but obviously glowing with health. Mangle coughed politely and indicated that he was ready to begin reading the will. What followed was a long and very, very boring speech, much of which was wasted on Alfred, who sat swinging his legs and staring abstractly out of the window. Boris was beginning to wonder where all this was leading, since money had not been mentioned once. Unseen by any of them, except fleetingly Alfred, a ragged and glass-stained midget listened intently on the fire escape. His original purpose in coming here was apparent from the throwing knife clenched between his broken teeth. Revenge. But something in Mangle's boring monologue caught him completely by surprise. As Reticule stood by the window, ready to beat a hasty retreat, Mangle drew finally to a conclusion. Both men had spent a considerable time examining the papers in Grip's office, searching hard for a loophole in the will, or anything that could possibly delay or prevent its execution. They both knew now that the trust was worthless, its assets systematically stripped by the senior partner in what looked like a wild orgy of uncharacteristic behavior, the excesses of which had probably contributed to his demise. It was Reticule who found it. Between the pages of a faded diary in the old man's desk was a letter written in Elsie's hand, intended to be opened on this day. It explained everything, and Mangle was slowly leading up to a point where its contents would be revealed to the occupants of the room.
"What did you say, Mangle?"
said Boris, as Mangle concluded.
"Should I read you the last bit again?"
inquired Mangle courteously. Boris blinked and nodded, speech mercifully denied him.
"It says," continued Mangle, "that should the boy's true father, he was illegitimate, you know, choose to reveal himself and take charge of his son, then such monies and properties would be bound over to him, the father, their disposal to be at his discretion, and all former arrangements made null and void."
Boris's jaw clenched, and an angry tick darted about his cheek.
"Mangle, you troublesome little bookend, do I take it from your tone of voice that someone has come forward?"
he growled, rising from the chair and glaring furiously at Mangle.
"In a manner of speaking,"
smiled the solicitor smugly.
"Don't give me that, you vile little man. Who is the father, and where is he?"
Mangle paused for dramatic effect, and puffing out his little chest, replied silkily,
it was none other than our Mr. Grip.
Good God!
As mayhem broke loose in the office, in the cordoned-off street just behind them, officers of the anti-terrorist squad gathered in number. PC Wormhole had trailed what he thought to be a team of anarchist saboteurs from a spot somewhere near Dunhenge.
Up on the fire escape,
he whispered to an important-looking official.
We reckon he blew up the police station at Mugging Flats as well.
The 24 police snipers, hidden in the eaves of an overlooking building, simultaneously released the safety catches on their high-powered rifles as they awaited the order that would unleash a deadly hail of bullets into Mangle's office.
Reckon we can mop up the old communist cell in one go,
the officer continued. Unseen by the anti-terrorist squad at the back of the office and in total secrecy, the fraud squad, hot on the heels of dead Mr. Grip's crooked accountant, and the combined forces of the Inland Revenue and Department of Trade and Industry, prepared to assault the officers from the front. As is usual, neither party was informed that there was another operation on that day. Reticule had been edging steadily towards the window, and as Mangle's revelation stunned the occupants into shocked silence, he prepared to leap out of it and onto the fire escape, where Frankel lurked unseen.
Come on, Mangle, we're waiting.
It would seem that we have all been sadly misled.
Quite so.
In 1950, Elsie Pack, your sister, was engaged in a passionate affair.
Disgusting.
With none other than our senior partner, Mr. Grip.
Who?
The result of their union was Alfred Pack. They both set up a fund to provide for the boy's future. Elsie paid huge sums of money into it.
Quite so.
Unfortunately, their guilty secret was discovered by one other, another circus performer, I believe, by the name of Hubert the Magnificent.
What?
Who saw fit to blackmail Mr. Grip for years.
Bastard.
And for years, Mr. Grip paid him. Unfortunately, by embezzling most of the contents of the Pact Trust. It's all a bit unfortunate, really.
Unfortunate? I'll show you unfortunate.
On the fire escape outside, the scorched dwarf could plainly hear all that was taking place in the room. His eyes, wide in astonishment, beheld two shadowy figures thrown against the dusty window. Boris, now grasping Mangle by the throat, was not yet aware that old Grip was dead and no longer an obstacle to Alfred's inheritance. Reticule, now convinced that this was all going to turn very nasty indeed, opened the window and leapt onto the fire escape. Frankel, lurking there with murderous intent, grabbed him by the testicles and threw him back into the room. Boris, Mangle and Hubert, now engaged in mortal combat, swiveled around to stare wide-eyed at the tiny intruder, dragging Reticule along by the tender parts. Outside, at the front door, the fraud squad prepared to break in. At the back of the building, a tall figure in a black uniform muttered into his radio. For a moment, as the door caved in and the room was suddenly filled with strangers in trench coats, there was a silence in which you could have heard a pin drop. Then, from below, a loud hailer barked menacingly. What followed was a misunderstanding, the like of which is not uncommon when armed men gather in huge numbers. The fraud squad, suddenly aware that they were not alone in this operation, flung open the window and told the distant voice to bugger off. It was their pinch, and they added for good measure a rude gesture. A movement which, when seen from a distance down a telescopic gun sight, could easily be interpreted as, "Sod off, copper, you won't take me alive." The resultant carnage was indescribable, as the order to
"hold your fire"
was quite understandably misinterpreted as
"shoot the bastards."
Alfred pulled the watering can back over his head and lay flat on the floor as bullets ricocheted around the walls. In the office next door, old Mr. Grip, now little more than a pin-striped suit filled with corruption, grinned grotesquely his mummified lips pulled back over teeth still amazingly white, seeming to mock the events going on next door. A gust of wind disturbed the room for a moment, and with a last great shudder, he fell to pieces in a cloud of dust, leaving nothing but kneecaps and teeth. In the kitchen at the big house, Myrtle wrenched the giblets out of the pheasant with far more passion than was strictly necessary. She had been told that game birds should be hung for a week to improve their flavour. No one, sadly, had told her that they should be killed first, and the last week in the kitchen had been a bedlam of flapping wings and pecking beaks. In the front room, Boris flung another armadillo on the fire and sighed deeply. On either side of the fireplace, the stuffed figures of Mangle and Reticule, now depicted as two heroic figures dressed in loincloths, held illuminated globes over their heads, but did little to dispel the gloom of the room. Hubert, the long-case clock, chimed mournfully in the hall as Boris poured himself another large brandy. Alfred opened the cigar box carved from a human skull and passed a cigar to his uncle. Putting his feet on the ginger-striped footstool with the funny bow legs, Boris flicked the ash from his cigar into Frankel the ashtray's open mouth.
"Hmm,"
he mused.
"What a pity old Grip was past stuffing.